The Way Out Podcast, episode 198.
I've been sober for 9.5 years, and it's been full of the challenges that life brings. But you know what? Recovery is not a challenge. Recovery is an amazing choice, and it makes everything in my life bearable and everything in my life livable. I had a few tough experiences when I was a child. I was molested by 2 teenage boys who lived in the neighborhood. I was only 6 years old, and I didn't have the words to tell my parents what happened. So I grew up with that shame, blame, and I buried that story, and I had no idea that most of the people that end up using and drinking have had experiences like that as children. I was raised in a fairly repressive religion where everybody else was going to die except for us, and we were going to get to live forever on God's paradise earth. So I grew up thinking I had the truth and nobody else did. So that was an ego thing. It was actually harder to get my mind out of that religion than it was to get up, to get free of the drugs, because it was so ingrained in me. Finding a higher power in the rooms that has really helped every part of my recovery from all different kinds of things. And it gave me a whole new perspective on my life. The first time around, it was all new and the pink cloud was there, and I prayed and meditated much more than I do even now to this day. And I had wonderful spiritual experiences. The second time around was more, I was jaded when I first got back, came to meetings. I was jaded for almost a year. And I felt like I didn't belong. And I went, I'd leave the meeting and people would be talking to each other, and I thought I didn't feel a part of. So I was a service. So I started, you know, putting myself into bringing cake. I got to join that friendly camaraderie of people talking about that because I was involved. And that made a huge difference in my sobriety this time around, and being able to feel a part of instead of separate from. So that was very positive. This time around, I had also begun to do this nonprofit work, and I poured myself into it this time. And it's, you know what? If you've got a purpose in life that's important to you, that you're passionate about, it gives me something, because I was a human, complete human being before I had children. And one of my children, my 2 children that are youngest, won't have anything to do with me. It's been 14 years. I could make my life bitter and shallow and be mad at the world about that. Or I could say, what are my talents and how can I help somebody? And that's what I'm going to do. Sometimes you give people the biggest gift by just listening to them and saying, how are you doing today?
Welcome, Way Out faithful and first timers, to this week's installment of the Way Out Podcast. We appreciate your ears. Our mission is simple: to bring you powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics so you can jumpstart or re-energize your recovery from alcoholism and addiction. The Way Out Podcast does not speak on behalf of, nor are we affiliated with, any 12-step organization. The Way Out Podcast partners with All Recovery Rings and allrecoveryrings.com, where you'll find stunning recovery rings made from your very own recovery coin. That's allrecoveryrings.com. The Way Out Podcast is a proud supporter of Transitions Daily. Would you like to join a free, anonymous online group that offers a daily topic email with popular recovery resources accompanied by a secret Facebook group for discussion? Go to dailyaaemails.com for more information about Transitions Daily. Don't forget to share dailyaaemails.com with friends, in meetings, and with sponsees in recovery. Make sure to check us out on the web at www.wayoutcast.com. There you can subscribe to ensure you get the latest episodes first on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, or your favorite podcast platform. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Help us recover out loud by giving us a 5-star rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Your voice matters, so share your thoughts on recovery with us by calling us at 218-382-1960 or leaving a message with us on the Anchor app, available for Android and Apple. Every week, we'll be asking for your thoughts on next week's topic. Someone, somewhere needs to hear your share. Finally, a word of caution. This podcast may contain strong language and mature content. Listener discretion is advised.
The Way Out Podcast is on right now. I'm Charlie. And in this edition of The Way Out, we've got a truly wonderful and insightful interview with Kelly Martin, a dear friend of mine who I had the pleasure of meeting inside the rooms of one of my favorite 12-step fellowships. There's an old saying in the rooms of recovery to describe someone who has allowed their sobriety and recovery to permeate their entire being, mind, body, and soul. It goes like, you know, that so-and-so wears their sobriety like a loose-fitting garment. And that's exactly the feeling I get every time Kelly and I get the opportunity to talk recovery. Kelly's journey to recovery was not easy, perfect, or always pretty. She had to persevere through some incredibly difficult stuff as a child. She had to shed old ideas about God and life that were not serving her any longer. She had to come back to the rooms after a wicked relapse and be intentional about reconnecting to a higher power and getting involved in the 12-step program and fellowship. She had to find peace with the fact that her two adult children still, after nearly a decade of sobriety, will not have anything to do with her. Kelly's story proves to us that we can have meaningful, enduring, and satisfying lives in recovery that are not perfect fairy tale endings. You're in for a real treat, Way Outcasters. Kelly is the real deal, and her story delivers an undeniably rich combination of spiritual truth, relatable experiences, and practical wisdom we can all apply to our own recovery toolkits. So listen up. Kelly Martin, thank you so much for taking time to join the Way Out podcast and share your experience, strength, and hope with our listeners. I'm very grateful.
It's really good to be here, Charlie. I'm very blessed to be able to do this, and I look at things that come up as challenges and opportunities in life, and when we share our experience, strength, and hope, when that reaches somebody else's heart, they think, "Hey, I can do that too." And I've heard in the rooms people share their stories, and it did the same thing for me. So it's nice to be here today.
So why don't you take some time to introduce yourself to the Way Out podcast audience. Tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been sober, and then we'll jump into your story.
All right. Well, let's see. I've been sober for 9.5 years, and it's been full of the challenges that life brings. But you know what? Recovery is not a challenge. Recovery is an amazing choice, and it makes everything in my life bearable and everything in my life livable, because just for today is how I go about my life, and that's a good way to be. I grew up in Anaheim, just a couple blocks from Disneyland, and I grew up thinking Tinkerbell and Peter Pan were real because I could see the fireworks at night. I saw Tinkerbell go off the Matterhorn, and I thought, life is just lovely. And I had a few tough experiences when I was a child. I was molested by two teenage boys who lived in the neighborhood. I was only 6 years old, and I didn't have the words to tell my parents what happened. Mm. So I grew up with that shame, blame, and I buried that story. And I had no idea that most of the people that end up using and drinking have had experiences like that as children. So as an adult, I get to process it through my adult mind and my adult emotions and be able to process that as just something that happened that was a part of my life. It's kind of like remembering when you were a kid and maybe you hurt your knee really bad and it was terrible, and then the knee got all better. And if you remember that time you skid off on your bicycle and did that, oh yeah, that really hurt, but it doesn't crush you emotionally. So that's the point. That's the point that I reached, was the experiences are just, It's not saying, oh, it was just a scraped knee, but it's saying, yeah, that was really a tough time in my life, but there's a healing from it where it doesn't have the same crushing emotional hold. So that was an interesting part about finding a higher power in the rooms that has really helped every part of my recovery from all different kinds of things. And it gave me a whole new perspective on my life. I was raised in a fairly repressive religion where everybody else was going to die except for us, and we were going to get to live forever on God's paradise earth. So I grew up thinking I had the truth and nobody else did. So that was an ego thing that really took me a long time to grow out of too. And you know, it was actually harder to get my mind out of that religion than it was to get free of the drugs, because it was so ingrained in me.
Isn't that something? And you know, Kelly, adverse childhood experiences and ACEs, as you so astutely pointed out, are very common in those of us who have addiction and alcoholism and substance abuse issues. Those ACEs, those adverse childhood experiences, are very common. And at 6 years old, you just don't have the tools. You just don't, like you said, you didn't have the words. You didn't have the words. You didn't have the tools to be, even to begin to deal with something of that magnitude.
Yeah, you're right. Because what it does is it puts you in a state of trauma, and it gives you a case of PTSD. PTSD is not a moral defect. You're not sick. You have an area of your brain that was so shocked and traumatized that you've actually got electrical energy going in that part of your brain that says you want to get out of here. You want to run. You want to fight. You want to freeze. And it's no different than your circuit panel getting overloaded in your house. Well, you got to shut all this stuff down that's running like crazy, and then you fix the wiring problem. And so there's nothing wrong with you. It is a bioelectrical problem in your brain. And once you have the tools to help calm that down, then you quit overreacting to it. Your amygdala in your brain is the fight or flight response area. And when that starts calming down, you just feel better about your whole life. You start to have a different perspective on it, and you get to integrate that memory with your whole life, as opposed to something that glaring stands out in the trauma and shock. And so I've learned one of these things I would recommend to every single person. There's a wonderful thing called emotional freedom technique, and you can look it up on the internet, and it is an amazing thing if you look up EFT. And it's a tapping procedure that works with your nervous system, and it helps to calm you down. So when your brain is saying, oh my God, I'm upset over this emotion I had because I remembered something that really happened to me that was bad, when you do that simple tapping technique, it helps your sympathetic nervous system calm down. It settles your brain down. And so I've used that quite a bit, and it's really helped. It helps for nightmares. It helps for all kinds of things. You can find it on the internet if you Google EFT.
And we'll have that in the show notes as well. So check the show notes after you're done listening, and I will have the reference to the EFT and emotional freedom technique so that you can research that if you so desire. One of the things that you brought up, which I think is really instructive about PTSD, is framing it as something that can A, be remedied, and B, isn't our fault, right? That the shame around PTSD and the stigma are often associated with PTSD really isn't helpful. We need to understand that it's a result of something that wasn't our fault. And even if, you know, we did have a part to it, having the shame around it doesn't help us. What we really need to understand is that can be remedied through a variety of techniques. I myself had to move through some PTSD, and you're right. Your amygdala, your brain, gets into a persistent state of overactivity, of anxiety, of alertness, right? Because I didn't expect to be traumatized, and so I felt caught off guard, right? And I felt ambushed by the event, which means that the way that my brain responded was to always be on guard, right?
Yes, and you feel like you were betrayed by the world. You're angry about everything. Mm. You can't trust anything, and all that's going on. And what it is incident-related trauma to an area of your brain that is, it is, and that's the flight or fright response. And it helps you if you're a gazelle on the savannah in Africa and you've got a lion chasing you. That's what it's for. And when the memory comes up, your whole body's geared to run away because that's, it's trying to save your life. And it doesn't know it hasn't stopped yet. And the EFT helps the PTSD because it calms that down enough to where you, oh my gosh, I'm safe right here. And it's an amazing process, but yeah, it made me feel better when a therapist told me this. She says, oh my gosh, you have incident related trauma and you haven't integrated it into your life yet. And the therapies are very, very good. EMDR is a great therapy, and the tapping is too. So you know what? And I took hold of this and I said, okay, this is my responsibility to pursue this. What is this? Let me look at it instead of saying, oh, nothing's going to help. I'm just feeling down all the time. So, and you know what? It works wonderfully with a 12-step program, and it also helps for addiction issues and all kinds of things. So those therapies are wonderful. And the nice thing, I will stress, I got out of a very bad place that I didn't even know I was in. Mm. Because I was using these other things and very involved in my 12-step program. So it's nice to be able to know you can take charge. You can say, yes, I'm going to try this. And you're going to, I just feel so much better.
There's a recognition at some point, especially as we enter sobriety and recovery, that these things aren't serving us anymore. And there's a lot of things that we can do in order to move through these things that aren't serving us anymore. And that constant PTSD fight or flight response is definitely one of those things that I had to move through because it wasn't serving me anymore. I'm a huge advocate of EMDR. I'll reference that as well as in the show notes.
Yeah.
Because, yeah,
it's all the modalities we can. You're right.
Absolutely. Transformational for me and a huge advocate of that. So Kelly, let's take it from your childhood. After that traumatic experience, what was life like after that growing up and getting into your teenage years?
What happened was I buried it and it was just stuck back in a little file someplace in my brain. And the thing I'll tell you is I noticed I would get so angry. I wasn't happy till I was even with people. If somebody bothered me, I wanted to get even with them. And I would do it passive aggressive or overtly. But I had a rage point that would come up and I would just be so angry. And this wasn't all of the time. I did have some great altruistic things that I was involved in as a kid. We helped other people in our religious community and things like that. But because this stuff runs in the back of your subconscious, it wasn't addressed. My teen years were very much spent in the religion and our little close community. I got to a certain age where some things had happened that I just saw were not fair. And I'm saying, how can a God be loving and kind when he's going to kill my father for not being a member of that religion? And I would cry myself to sleep, please God, don't kill my daddy. And that was very real to me because dad wasn't in the church. So I grew up, got married, had two children, and certain other things happened in the religion. It was very male-based. The women were not allowed to do any part of the services there. And you also, they discouraged you going to college. And I didn't even finish high school, and that was okay with them because then you could spend more time going door to door with their literature. Mm. And I realized I got to 24 and I went, I'm almost a quarter of a century old. I have no marketable skills and I'm not happy with my religion anymore. Something's wrong. So I think I had a small nervous breakdown. I decided to go enroll in college and not tell anybody because the church wouldn't have approved of that because women shouldn't go out and go to college. And I did, and I got a taste of, hey, this is fun out here. So I started drinking, using a little bit of drugs, and ended up getting a divorce, got remarried to someone who was very hostile, aggressive, and abusive, and was in that marriage for 13 years. And one day I snapped and said, I'm done with this. And I started using crack and drinking and got a divorce from him and was on a full-scale party for 4 years. Thought I had found the solution to all my problems. If I could just smoke crack the rest of my life, I'd be fine. Hmm. And I became delusional and had just complete incomprehensible demoralization from what the drugs were doing to my system. And a social worker and a police officer came and took my two youngest children. They walked out of my house. That night I fell to my knees and I said, God, I use the name we use in that church. I said, God, if that's your name, I'm in a shitload of trouble with you. But if it isn't, would you please help me? I don't know what to do. I need help. And I'm crying and crying. And I fell asleep on the couch and fully expecting the ministers of that church to come to my door with their literature. And I said, I'll do it if that's what it is. Mm. The phone rang and it was a friend of mine who knew of my problems. And he said, Kelly, there's a 12-step meeting at Hoag Hospital. It's Wednesday night at 7:30. Get yourself there if you want help. And I said, okay. And I hung up the phone and I remember looking up to God and saying, thank you for not sending me back to that religion. And I packed. I did. Thank you. I didn't want to. I was going to do it, but I'm really glad this was the answer. So I went to that first meeting and people were laughing and they were happy and they talked about going out on a boat. We're all going to have a boat cruise, Bob. And I go, how do you go on a boat and not drink? I was literally dumbfounded by that. And I kept coming back and I kept going back for 7 years. It was wonderful. Quit drinking, quit using, never got my kids back. Which is, you know what, I could stay clean and sober anyway. But I had a four-year relapse because I got a resentment when they turned 18 and shut me out of their lives, and I haven't heard from them for 14 years. That was very, very painful. Mm. But
so a couple questions. Were your parents married, divorced? You had mentioned that Dad wasn't in the religion, but Mom was, right?
No, my mom became this religion when I was 5 years old, and okay. Dad was an agnostic.
Got it.
And Dad was easygoing, funny, laughed at stuff, was a wonderful, wonderful father. And Mom was a little more critical of things, her world, she loved the religion because every question was answered for you. You didn't have to think for yourself. Mm. And I adopted that religion too. So, but no, my parents had a good marriage. They didn't talk about really important things with one another. So there was a lot of things that didn't, she always said, don't tell your father, you know, it was almost sure. Family secrets. Don't tell your dad this, he'll get upset. Nobody was supposed to be upset or hate anybody or really be angry at people. Mm. You're supposed to always have that. God doesn't want you to be mad at them, so you better not. So it was a lot of feelings that were denied actually at the time. But they had a decent marriage. They were married for 50 years, and I wouldn't trade my parents for any parents. They, you know, your family is your greatest classroom you'll ever have in your life if you're only paying attention and you work on those issues. And the first thing I ask myself is, what is my part in these issues? And if it's a boundary for me, I can say it calmly and firmly without waiting till I'm so furious I blow up. And that's what the principles in the 12 steps have taught me.
So mom would go to church, but dad would stay home.
Dad was agnostic. He said, I'm not going to talk to you about your invisible friend.
I love it. So you have a 7-year stint of sobriety. I think that's so instructive, Kelly, because that's considered by most as long-term sobriety. And
yes.
And after 7 years, a very painful experience happens in your life that ends up being a catalyst for a relapse.
And Charlie, I will tell you, part of it is I was just really plugged in, going to meetings, and when the custody stuff was going on, and then the kids wouldn't talk to me, I had ended up thinking I kind of was all that. Wow, I'm never going to drink or use again. This is great. I've got this. Mm-hmm. And so when I got that resentment, I said, screw it. I don't have to go to meetings. I can do what I want. And so for about 6 months, I stayed sober. And then it was something so simple as my sister said, oh, here, try this. And I took a sip of this fizzy drink. And I said, wait a minute, is there alcohol in here? She goes, you're not going to let those people run your life, are you? Mm. You're not going to let them. Why should they tell you anything? So basically, it was peer pressure. And I went, no, I think I'm going to let you influence me. I'm going to have this drink and end up on meth in 4 months and be a flipping, falling down, blacked out, raging, screaming, throwing suitcases through windows because I'm mad at somebody. And it was just absolutely horrible the second time around. And the thing was, I knew when I took that first, when I was smoked meth, I wasn't happy. I was just high and I knew the difference. And I went, my God, what have I done to myself? So I quit that. I kept drinking until for another 2 years. I knew my family. I knew in my bones they were going to do an intervention. I could feel it. So I drank that weekend, dumped everything down the sink, and went to a meeting the next night. I think I was probably still very hungover. And then I went to a meeting the night after that. And then I called my family. And I'll tell you why. I had to go to that meeting. And because if I say, I'm going to go back, well, that's a gonna. You're going to do lots of things in your life. What have you done? I went to 2 meetings and then called everybody and said, I'm back at meetings. I knew I couldn't lie. I knew I couldn't say gonna. I had to do it. So I hung my head. I couldn't look anybody in the eye. I was like every other person with a relapse. My God, what have I done? Yeah. It took a year before I felt a part of it again. And I got it from having a commitment. And that was great. I was of service and really got a wonderful, wonderful home group. And what I did the last time, I had slacked off on my meetings. And so this year, when I was clean and sober, for 7 years, I was terrified the whole year. Okay. So I went to extra meetings. I called somebody in sobriety every day. I was paying attention to it because I slacked off. So to me, having that fellowship is just one of the most amazing things, because you see other people just like you that have problems, that people die, that have medical issues, and they're staying in it. And that's what I wanted this time, to stay in it. And I don't look at myself and say, oh, you're all that. You've got all these years. It's like, honey, I've got today. And it means no matter what today. And so that's a great, that's a great place to be. I stay humble because I know how easy it is to get back on that other path. And honey, I don't want anything to do with that. So the way I circumvent that is my program comes first.
When you first drank, got high, or both, some of us have, sort of that one drug of choice that, really did it for us and fell in love with. Was it like that for you? Was there, was it a memorable experience the first time you drank or used?
I remember getting sips of dad's beer when I was a kid, and it was funny. My sister took it and said, "Oh, yuck, this is yucky." And I took a sip and went, "Oh, it's kind of yucky, but I want more." Mm-hmm. So I was getting to where dad wouldn't let me get his beers anymore because I'd drink about a fourth of it and I'd be six or seven. You know, I'd drink a fourth of it getting it to him. And then I first got rip-roaring drunk when I was about 15 over some boy thing. He doesn't like me. He likes her, whatever. And I drank and I got so, I had a two-day hangover and a blackout. And so I was off and running with the booze. But when I smoked crack for the first time, I thought, oh my God, this is it. This is all I need the rest of my life. This will solve all my problems because everything's perfect now. And it probably went on for a good 4 months before I started. That was all I wanted and I didn't want anything else. And that was my, oh my God, that was horrible. I wanted to stop so bad and couldn't do it.
Hmm. And when you got to that point, you said after your relapse, you could just feel it, right? You could just feel that there was an intervention coming, right?
I knew it because I was so bad. I had stopped. I was on meth for about 6 weeks and I stopped because I looked at my eyes and I went, oh my God, I can't do this to myself. I'm vacant. I'm not even there. I have to stop this. But the drinking kept on, and the drinking was driving me into the ground. I had the DTs horribly. I would see ugly faces on the walls because that's what the alcohol will do. And I should have been in the hospital. I was really, really ill. And I cut back on it for a couple weeks. Actually, I quit for 6 weeks just on willpower. And I tell you what, 6 weeks was all I had, started drinking again. And I knew they were going to do an intervention. I just felt it. Mm. So that was I don't want to live through an intervention. I can't do that to myself or my family. I've got to do something about it. And I don't know how to stop drinking on my own. And it was funny. I'd pray. I'd say, God, please, I don't want to drink anymore. And then I'd reach into the cabinet where the vodka was, pour it in my coffee in the morning. Mm. And I would hear very clearly, there's a meeting two blocks away from you. This is already done. I heard it just plain as I just said it to you. Mm. And that's true. There's a meeting I can walk to. It's two blocks from my house. And so I went, okay, this is it. This is it. And it was saying goodbye to the booze again, which I had done once before. So it was kind of a death feeling, you know. I'm going, oh my God, I'm going to live. And he says, okay, just knock it off. Just go.
There's no doubt about it, Kelly. I can so identify with this feeling that I mourned my drug of choice, right?
Yeah.
I mourned it. Because for better or for worse, and at the end, definitely for worse, it got me through. Where I don't know if I would have gotten through otherwise. And I say that because I didn't have the tools. So I honestly, you know, do have some compassion for myself around that, you know, at least I had some temporary relief, although that ended up being, you know, the monster itself.
I completely agree with you. It was, there are some things that are so difficult to deal with that, and you don't have to do it all at once. You do it a little bit at a time. And that was what I really hung on to. I don't have to do this all. Thank God for that. I can do this one day at a time. Thank God for that. And it's looking back going, okay. And I went through that relapse. And one of the nice things about that is, it gave me more empathy for people that have relapses, and it showed me how easy it is to let go of everything you've had. And, you know, if you've got a horrible blister on your heel, you can ignore it, and it's going to fester and be there a long time. But if you carefully take care of that, it's going to get better. And I knew that process was going to work again, and it truly did. I also have 240 inmates that are incarcerated in prisons across the from Hawaii to Alabama and mostly in California. And I've got a program called, it's a nonprofit organization called Insights Foundation. And my part of that is I teach inmates positive living skills, and it's very 12-step program based. And it is also different techniques. I share the EMDR. I share the EFT with them. When they write letters to me, and I've got about 120 that write regularly. So I'm very busy right now in my sobriety doing things like that, not out worrying about where the next drink is. I'm worrying about, okay, do I have paper for my printer so I can write this person? And for me, it's when they write to me, they answer the homework that I've sent them. And I read it over. And first of all, it's I communicate, appreciate, and validate them. And by communicating, I listen to what they have to say, their problems, whatever they are. Even if I think they're trivial, even if I think this person's not getting it. Oh, you're having this problem with your uncle who said he was going to do this and didn't do it. So I repeat their problem back to them so they know I've heard them. Because if you're not listening, you're not going to know that person. So that's communicate. And then I appreciate their work. Well, thank you for doing this in one of the hardest places in the world for self-improvement, the prison. I truly respect your efforts at this. So even if I disagree with everything they're saying, I can say I respect their efforts because they're making one. They might not have gotten this principle yet, but they're working on it, and they don't get that. They don't get that. They don't get that appreciation shown to them in the situation they're in by the inmates and the guards and all that, because prison's not a nice place to be. So I give that, I communicate, appreciate, and validate them. And I can validate their feelings without agreeing with any one of them. And sometimes I don't. Sometimes I do. Some of the things that they've had to put, that you put up with in prison are tough. And I don't try to get them out because that's not my job. Thank God I wouldn't want to be on the parole board. They've got a tough job. But my job is to dig into these issues. And I will tell you 80%, at least 80% of the women had sexual abuse when they were children, all kinds of physical abuse, verbal abuse, and 40% of the men have had sexual abuse and physical abuse when they were children. And that is the reason, that's deep down inside, I'm not safe in this world, so I have to hide myself, and let me find some drugs and alcohol because that makes me feel great for a while until the addiction hits, and then you're not in any control anymore. So having them understand these concepts and teach them, we teach them also, how to deal with a panic attack, anxiety, mood swings, all these other things. It's a very holistic program where we deal with treating the body properly, the mind and the spirit along, and it goes wonderfully with the principles in any 12-step program.
I love the work that you're doing in this nonprofit with folks who are incarcerated. I think it's a wonderful, wonderful mission to be able to help folks who don't have tools, who ended up in prison primarily because of a lack of an ability to be able to cope. One of the things you said very early on was this profound anger that you dealt with in your childhood. I had a very similar experience in my childhood with a profound sense of anger at the world, at God, and that I would end up sort of taking that anger out in unexpected ways. And often I was surprised
by
the anger.
Yep.
Right? And so was everybody else. Because I was so mad at the awful hand that I felt I had been dealt, right? And a lot of it took a lot of work, and it took a lot of willingness and open-mindedness and honesty to get through the anger piece, the PTSD, and then I had some mental health stuff. So the second time in that you launched yourself into recovery, Kelly, what was different? What changed from the first time? Because you had long-term sobriety. You had 7 years of sobriety, and now you're 9.5 years in. What's different?
You know, the first time around, it was all new, and the pink cloud was there, and I prayed and meditated much more than I do even now to this day. And I had wonderful spiritual experiences, the most powerful spiritual experiences I've ever had was when I was 9 months clean and sober, and it was absolutely beautiful and told me a lot about human potential and filling yourself with gratitude every opportunity you can. Be grateful for the thing that went right that day, even if the only thing that went right is you got one green light on your way home from work. Wow, let me think about that cool green light, because gratitude fills our soul in a way very other few things will, and there's something you can be grateful for in a day. Even if everything else looks like it's caving in, there is something to be grateful for. So the second time around was more, I was jaded when I first got back, came to meetings. I was jaded for almost a year, and I felt like I didn't belong, and I went, I'd leave the meeting and people would be talking to each other, and I thought I didn't feel a part of. So that's why I went, what am I going to do about this, you know, my higher power? What am I going to do? I feel so apart. Well, how do you feel together? So I was a service. So I started, you know, putting myself into bringing cake. And which is funny because I don't bake. My cakes fall, cave in on me, and it's kind of hysterical. I did that. And then it is that. I got to join that friendly camaraderie of people talking about that because I was involved, and that made a huge difference in my sobriety this time around and being able to feel a part of instead of separate from. So that was very positive. This time around, I had also begun to do this nonprofit work, and I could do some of it when I was drinking and tried to maintain it, but it was just a sloppy mess. I've thrown away everything I wrote then. And I poured myself into it this time. And it's, you know what, if you've got a purpose in life that's important to you, that you're passionate enough to sit yourself down at a computer, and when your back needs to be stretched out, you can barely pull yourself away because you are so involved in what you're doing, you can't wait for the next letter. And it'll be challenging. You're going, oh, shoot, this person wants this. How do we do that? But it gives me something because I was a human, complete human being before I had children. And one of my children, my two children that are youngest, won't have anything to do with me. It's been 14 years. I could make my life bitter and shallow and be mad at the world about that. Or I could say, what are my talents and how can I help somebody? And that's what I'm going to do. And of course, I'm going to miss my kids. I'm not saying that doesn't happen. But I don't have to wallow in it. I make myself a little appointment. Oh, you want to be upset about Aaron and Michael? Okay, go cry. And you're done? You're 15 minutes? Okay, good. And I give myself time to mourn that loss of the past 15 years. But I found something that I'd be doing if I had never had kids. I found something that if I never had any losses or pains or traumatic experiences, I'd still want to do this. But with my losses and my pains and my traumatic experience, I share this with what I've told you today with 250 people. That's out in my introduction letter. Here is my life. And that's an amazing, wonderful thing. And it's being able to take all those horrible, nasty, ugly things and say, these things happen, and here's, it was hard, and my parents didn't understand, and here's how I went along, and when I finally got this, now here's the basis and foundation of my life. We are here to help each other, and we use our gifts to help each other, and I share this with them, and that's why I'm here, so all kinds
really,
of crappy.
Yeah, it really sounds like you, a couple things, as I listen to how you talk about your sobriety after coming back after a relapse, it really sounds maybe a bit more authentic in that, you know, it was hard at first and you didn't feel connected at first. And you really had to dig in. and do some work and some service work, and that maybe there was some more honesty around, like, hey, you know, I ain't feeling it right now, and I'm struggling right now, and this doesn't feel good right now. And, you know, that honesty piece, even if we are not doing superstar right now, like having that honesty around it so people can help us and identify with us and say, yeah, you know what, I felt like that too, and here's what I did, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And all of this doesn't feel great. You know, there's things in life that aren't going to feel good. And those, but every single event in human life has a beginning, a middle, and an end. And it is recognizing that, but it never seems like that, Charlie. It always seems like, oh my God, this is the only thing going on right now. And yeah. Oh my God, they can empty the trash and I'm blowing up. And it goes from the mundane to the tragedy, but all that stuff, but it still has a beginning. And if you stop and look at your whole life, you know, oh my God, the first broken heart you had, you're never going to get over it. Well, that was when you were 13. Okay, how about the next one? Oh, I'm never getting over that. Well, that was in your 20s or 14s. But you did. And that's the thing. We see our life as an integrated whole. It takes the weight off your shoulders, and you go, I'm having a bad time now, and this part of my life is hard. So what do? I get to go share it with somebody. And something I love, it's called the Other Serenity Prayer, and it's, God, grant me the serenity to stop beating myself up for not doing everything perfectly, the courage to forgive myself because I'm working on doing better, and the wisdom to know that you already love me just the way I am.
I love that.
Oh yeah, that one is just like, okay, God isn't expecting me to do anything other than live my life. And then if I say, God, what would you like of me? And it's, can you step up, turn your energy up, and turn it out then? And that's what I'm doing. I'm turning it up and turning it out because I get to do this for people. And if, you know, if a mom's stuck at home with a bunch of little kids, and the thing is, when she takes a nice breath and does something to stretch and takes care of herself, the kids get to see that. And so she's a little more patient with them. And that is a wonderful, that is just as important as anything else. My sister's taking care of her grandkids. That's just as important to her as what I'm doing to me. The thing is to find what engages you, what gets you enthused, what you're going, oh my God, I really love this. And it might be something different next year. You might go, oh my God, now this thing is. And so you get to stay creative with your own life and what you're in it. And it helps you slog through the rough times a little bit easier.
I got to say, the Other Serenity Prayer to me is one of those things that, those gems, those spiritual gems that I wouldn't otherwise have been introduced to without having to do this amazing interview. So that's great. And we're going to have that in the show notes. So thank you, Kelly, for that. That is tremendous. It does remind me of the acronym for SHAME, which is, should have already mastered everything,
uh-huh.
Right? You know, this idea that, you know, I get in my head for sure that, you know, everything should go perfect all the time and I shouldn't have any difficulties because I'm sober. And that ain't reality, but I end up, you know, building up those expectations, I think. And I think that's normal. Having a good reminder and some self-forgiveness and some grace and some acceptance around the very real fact that life, in fact, will get lifey.
Yeah, and I like to remember that life is composed of living, moving, breathing things. That's what life is to me. The plants have it. They're sentient beings. They have a certain amount of awareness of themselves. So do turtles. It's in all things. And when you look at our cells, they're made of atoms, and that's constantly moving. And who knows, maybe we don't recognize atoms as a life form, and it could be. I have no idea. That's a mystery of the universe that I can't solve. So life itself is an amazing, wonderful process. To me, it's a situation that can be terrible. A situation can be horrendous, but that's not life. Mm. And we say that's an expression, hey, well, that's life. Yeah, it is. But I like to look at a little bit of the deeper meaning of what life is. Situations will come up and be difficult. And just you barely think you can get through. And you look at yourself and go, but gosh, I got through. I did. I got through. And I got through because I had help. I was feeling horrible. I drank. I used drugs for a while. But I got through. I got through to here. And here is better for me today. And what can I do to make that better for me? And when you focus on it, to me, it's kind of a mindset. We're so used to viewing things. It's oh, if it's storming, oh, it's terrible weather. Well, is it really? What if a person loves a storm and they see that come in, they see power and majesty and there's the lightning and they're excited by it. And another person's terrified, but it's all their perspective. And the person that's terrified, it's not necessarily wrong. Maybe they knew somebody got struck by lightning, who knows, but it's a perception. And once you have a slight shift in that, when you start telling yourself, well, this is challenging to drive in the snow today, instead of, oh my God, this is going to be awful, I might slide. As soon as you tell yourself, okay, it's a challenge, I'm going to pay attention. You just shift things in your brain because your brain is like an amazing motherboard. You have downloaded something into it. When we start paying attention to things like, you know, like this other serenity prayer, it's a little bit more of an uplift than the other way of viewing it. And it takes conscious awareness because we've had a lifetime in a society and a culture that is always based on lack. You lack things, so go spend a bunch of money, listen to our commercials and watch the news, and we'll give you your dose of adrenaline and make you totally miserable, and you come do it again because now we've got you addicted to the adrenaline and misery. And you go, oh, I'm going with that because I always have. But if you start going, yeah, I'm going to skip that today and I'm going to watch a sitcom instead, or I'm going to, you know, hear a funny story. I've got a great one. One man who was in prison, who was writing to us, who was in prison for armed robbery of a bank. He dressed up as an old woman. He was on meth and he got caught and put in prison. Had some terrible things happen to him in prison, a nightmare. And he ended up with our materials, started writing to him. He caught on to this and it was incredible. When he got out, he's getting a PhD in healthcare. He's already working for on a panel with the governor of the state of Colorado, and he's a part-time, works for us part-time writing articles for a nonprofit organization. So it is a slight shift in perception, and sometimes you give people the biggest gift by just listening to them and saying, how are you doing today? And you really listen and you drop your agenda and you quit being in a hurry and realize it's not all that important if you get the trash out. Maybe it is, but you'll do it later. And to be able to share that with them. So we've got a lot of stories like that of people that are getting out and taking these tools we provide, but we show them how to use it and it's up to them. But Stephen is he's one of our amazing, wonderful stories, and he's so very grateful.
One of the things I think that is illustrated through the work that you're doing is what I've learned is, you know, our purpose, my purpose specifically here is, you know, on this earth is to live as close as I can and embody as much as I can to live in love and service of others. And when I do that, I am more at peace, more content, more serene, and at peace with myself. And when I'm living in self-centeredness and in resentment and fear, I'm less at peace, less content, right? So in the service work, Kelly, that you're doing really embodies that principle of love and service for one another.
Yes, and it's when I sit here at the computer and I read somebody's letter, I get my highlighter and highlight things I want to read back to them that they've said, because that is a way they know you hear them. And so it is with the people you talk to in a day. If you're really listening, you repeat back, oh, and you went to the bank and then that lady did what? Because they know you're listening. And so that's the connection. That's the human connection you get to pass around in whatever way you decide that is for you. Some people, as Mother Teresa was in the trenches and took care of lepers.
Yes.
And that's what she did. Other people, Jacques Cousteau was into the ocean. And everybody gets to decide their contribution to life. And it makes you, once you get into that, parts of it will make you glow. And parts of it are hard to sit to, okay, I've got three letters. I better get out because these people I'm a little late on, so let's get going here. And really, it's a very fulfilling, amazing thing. And it also takes practice at doing whatever it is you want to be good at, and the awareness to know, what are you thinking about? What's your state of feeling right now? Are you in a hurry? Because being in a hurry for me is one of the biggest times that I forget all my stuff, you know? It's get out of my way, I'm in a hurry. So being able to set yourself up for success in whatever it is you've chosen to do. And it says chance favors the prepared mind. So the more prepared you are, to me it comes down to practice, Charlie. You practice what it is you want to bring more in your life, and it happens.
And recovery itself is a practice. We are practicing these principles. So Kelly, you and I met and know each other through the room. So I got to hear bits and pieces of your story, but really not all of it. And what a great experience for me to be able to be a part of you sharing your complete story. So this was tremendous. Thank you so much for that. Before we go, I want to ask you a few things.
Okay.
Number one, tell me just a little bit about your daily recovery routine, the things that you do every day that may seem small, maybe they're big, maybe they're somewhere in between, but are integral into your daily recovery routine.
I pay attention to my meetings in whatever form they happen to be in, meetings online, meetings in person. And when you can do that, when I do that, to me, that is because I pay attention. What made me lose it the first time? I slacked off the meetings. I slacked off on the fellowship. I slacked off talking to other alcoholics and addicts that are in recovery. And so that's a very important thing I pay attention to. I also read something of recovery every day, even that other serenity prayer, because we're very attached to the serenity prayer. And this other one, to me, is a slightly different perspective on that. And it's kind of lovely. It goes a little deeper. And it is looking at all these letters I have. I'll have a stack of them a foot and a half high sometimes if I've been behind. And knowing I have a purpose. I have a purpose in that my sobriety first, my recovery second, and my purpose. Because I get to have a purpose because of my sobriety and recovery.
What piece of literature or recovery material really made a big difference on your sobriety?
Looking back, well, I first got clean and sober back in 2000, and it would have been the Big Book. It would have been the Big Book because it was so different to me. And then I read everything I could about that particular society because I wanted to know. I was just, how does this work? Nice. Because there's so many people with so many different problems and addictions and cravings and everything. And somebody said, open your arms really wide. Open them wide. Can you get them all the way back so your hands touch? The program's wider than that. It lets everybody in. And it doesn't matter. It is so open-ended. All you have to do is be willing.
The best piece of recovery wisdom you've received is?
No matter what.
And that, to me, really expresses the willingness piece of this program, right? If I am willing even just a shred of willingness, it's all I need.
And it also is wonderful because after you put that into practice, after I put it into practice, things come into your life you can't have imagined, because boldness has power. When you decide you're willing, even if you crawl in at the beginning, once you start putting yourself into it, all of a sudden it's like colors will be sparklier, conversations will have more meaning. And when you really live the principles that are behind each one of those steps, the principles are what it's all about, the principles in life. And you don't have to do it perfect. I'm never going to. That's what amends are for, honey. And I'm more than willing to make all the amends I need to, because I get to be an imperfect human living this amazingly imperfect life, but I get to have something in it because I'm willing. Yes.
And that fundamental willingness really does bail me out on a fairly regular basis.
I am willing to tell you humbly and sincerely, I'm sorry for what I did. Yeah. That's an amazing thing to be able to do in life. A lot of people don't do it. They can't give an honest apology. They want to muck it up. And you know what? I did the same thing because I didn't know how. Finally learned. Just apologize for what I did and tell that person I'm sorry. How freeing is that? Then they don't hold it for the next 2 years, especially if you're married. Those women will hold on to stuff for 5 years. You better give them an honest apology so you can get past that thing.
In fact, that is correct. In fact, Kelly, thank you so, so much for taking time to share your experience, strength, and hope on the Way Out podcast. And thank you, everybody, in Way Out podcast land. We will talk to you next time.
Thank you for being a part of The Way Out. We appreciate your ears. We're sharing powerful recovery stories and recovery power topics every week, so keep listening up. If you would like to reach out to the show, you can visit us on the web at wayoutcast.com. That's wayoutcast, all one word, .com. There you can subscribe to the Way Out podcast on all of the major podcast aggregators, such as iTunes, CastBox, Stitcher, TuneIn, Podbean, Overcast, and more. Or simply drop your hosts a friendly email at share@wayoutcast.com. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, contact us at share@wayoutcast.com. See you next time, and remember, if you don't change, your sobriety date will.